Hello, this is a lecture on Vine Deloria and Daniel Wildcat. Now, these writers are honestly fairly new for me. I don't know them and their work or their position within theoretical histories the way I know the Western theoretical tradition. And basically, this is due to the insularity and exclusivity of the Western academic canon, and consequently, my own narrow view, coming as I do from within this Western theoretical education. I think it's important to recognize that we have been fed a certain canon which is internally self-referential and which both explicitly and implicitly downgrades and others other modes and histories of understanding. But it is equally important to reach outside of it, to learn from the traditions our colonial culture has suppressed, and thus to begin to other and to decolonize ourselves. In my own case, this is largely something that has happened by meeting activists and teachers coming from different disciplines and backgrounds and letting them teach me. I understand this as a core aspect of friendship. I would like to let my friendships erode my insularity, my self-involvedness, my lockage within disciplines and canons and modes of thought as much as possible. Such friends introduced me to the Black radical tradition as well as, more recently, to the indigenous thought that I share with you in this course. I learned of Vine Deloria through Tyiake Alfred's work and that of Glenn Coulthard, both of whom we'll encounter later in the semester. I include him and his student Daniel Wildcat here because they seem to me to give accessible pictures of some key concerns of indigenous political thought and theology and metaphysics, and because they seem to have been foundational in certain respects for the contemporary thinkers I'm familiar with. So my knowledge of Deloria is Wikipedia quality. You can read on him there yourself, but let me highlight a couple of details that seem pertinent. Deloria was Oglala Sioux from the Standing Rock Reservation. His father, like mine, was a Christian minister, a missionary to the reservation. Deloria studied theology in the Western tradition, which I can still hear in certain of his formulations, particularly when he discusses experience versus belief. There I still hear William James and his varieties of religious experience, and only afterwards turned back to focusing on Northern American Indian thought with an emphasis on self-determination, both at a broad political and territorial level, and then specifically with respect to education. Deloria came to prominence as a Native American thinker just as AIM, the American Indian Movement, emerged. His importance and the AIM occupations of Alcatraz Island, followed by an occupation of Mount Rushmore for the Sioux, who called it first, the Six Grandfathers. These are both place-based, longer-term actions focused largely on the iteration, or as Alfred will say, the resurgence of traditional rituals and practices, were synchronous. Deloria's place-centric thought and a broader Indian political land-based practice emerged simultaneously, or re-emerged simultaneously. This basis in place, along with an emphasis on place-based relationships and an insistence that knowledge and practice must coincide, are reasons for my including these texts in our course. So, probably the primary heading here is place and relations in place. The book from which I draw our primary reading is called Power and Place. One of the chapters, as you know, is titled Power Plus Place Equals Personality. Deloria presents what he takes to be core Indian understandings of who people are, what constitutes selves, and what our world is, and questions about what we should do, so Indian ethics, all in relationship with place. Who I am is the composite of my relationships in places, in real places. Much of his presentation, it seems to me, and Wildcat's too, is fairly reducible to a series of oppositions between features of the dominant Western colonial worldview and then the indigenous worldview. So let's start with a glance over that list, which will bring us back to place and power. Let's start with knowledge. Culturally, the highest knowledge in Western society, what we take to be real knowledge, and something on which we are strongly encouraged to pride ourselves, indeed, one of the things that is supposed to qualify Western society as inherently superior to Indian society, is science. In the West, in the society that has been imposed upon colonized peoples, what counts as knowledge has the form of law and generality. Scientists offer abstract hypotheses, then organize careful experiments. That is, they manipulate nature. They stage certain natural phenomena to test those hypotheses. If the hypotheses are consistently not falsified, these hypotheses start to look like laws, which is the goal of this science. Knowing means possessing general rules in the mind to which natural phenomena always comply. Inevitably, however, things that looked like laws do get falsified. A famous example, of course, is the breakdown of Newtonian physics in the domain of high-energy phenomena, but there are many more. Eventually, each Western knowledge breaks down. Abstract laws are seen to have exceptions, and a new quest begins to establish a new abstract law. This turnover is discussed in detail in Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and it shows up theoretically in Heidegger as Geschichten, the sendings of being, and in the early Foucault as epistemes, different structures of knowledge given historically and in different places. Though it is held up as a key aspect of alleged Western progress, that Western civilization is always moving forward towards some grand destiny, the theory of everything, manifest destiny, the democratization of the world, technological advancement, these treatments show that the movement is rather nonlinear. And if we look ecologically, socially, and economically, we can see that Western knowledge truly is embedded in practices which are devastating to all our relations, human, animal, plant, earth, air. Let's pause on abstract for a moment. Abstraction is central to Western knowledge from the pre-Socratics onward. That's like 500, 600 BCE, 2,500 years of this. Abstract means removed from experience. One cannot ever see the rule that E equals MC squared, nor the rule that massive bodies gravitationally attract one another according to the inverse square law. You don't see the inverse square law. These scientific laws are not part of the world, not part of the sensory world, the experiential world. They don't exist in experience. Rather, they account for some of the things that can be observed. Abstractions can only be thought. And it is what is only thought and applicable generally that counts as knowledge in the West. We are encouraged to praise this abstraction as a mark of high civilization and of the superiority of Western understandings to primitive, tribal ones. But Deloria and Wildcat see such knowledge as problematic. They insist that other forms of knowledge are at the least equal in quality. In terms of our investigation in this course, the abstraction here, the essential definitive removal from experience of the truest things, seems to be related to alienation. This was already apparent in Plato. The mind, said Plato, always moves away from sensory and felt reality, away from experience, towards some eternal domain where ideas and their relations are invariant. Only the invariant, the unchanging, the immaterial, that which is thought but never seen or touched, was for him ultimately real. In fact, Plato conceived the whole material domain as an irrational chaos and a fundamental danger. The physical world, delivering as it does pain and pleasure, threatens to crucify the soul to the body. It pulls the mind into its own swirling patterns, and in this process, the mind loses the capacity to free itself from the material domain, which is, on this prototypical Western model, the mind's whole calling. And we, of course, are supposed to be our minds, essentially, but not our bodies. Plato's attitude toward the physical world and towards knowledge as abstract was adopted by the Christian tradition, giving us an immaterial heaven, our home to which, if we are lucky, we shall return, a present immaterial, internal life under the surveillance of God, who sees all our thoughts, and then a corrupt, disgusting, but tempting and lascivious outer world, which we should suspect and from which good people withdraw as far as possible. This should sound familiar. So while Western knowledge is abstract, removed from experience, and general, not concerned with the particulars of any given situation, Deloria presents Indian knowledge as essentially experientially based, always concerned with particulars, and thus always tied into certain places, situations, and perspectives, and activities. Western knowledge identifies animal forms, for example, according to what it can generalize about bodies, brains, and behavior patterns, and it feels it has known when it has definitions that can be applied and not falsified in any circumstance. That there is a bear. I know its Latin name. Well, I don't. Something about Ursa. I know its structure. I know generalities of its behavior. Therefore, I know it. Indian knowledge, on the other hand, tunes into particular bears in particular circumstances. It watches individuals and gets to know them. It does not abstract, at least not like Western science. Sensation, perception, and experience are never derided. They are never conceived as lesser varieties of knowledge, far behind abstraction and mathematical formulas. To be in touch with real beings in real contexts, to see them in their detail, to distinguish individuals, is real knowledge. But this place-based knowledge extends beyond this as well, both spatially and temporally. Spatially, knowledge of individual animals and their family characteristics goes together with knowledge about the other types of animals around them, how they interact, goes with knowledge of plants and trees, the ones the bears like and the ones they don't. It goes together with human practices, too. If you wanted to kill a bear, which aspects of its behavior would you zoom in on? How could you trick it? This knowledge never stops being observationally based and experiential, nor does it allow a breakage between the theoretical domain, what the scientist is concerned with, and the practical domain, what the hunter cares about. Deloria and Wildcat emphasize that there is no alienation, no separation here. Knowledge is about connection with what surrounds us. But there is a temporal axis, too. There is a tradition of knowledge, which is what is handed down by elders to the young. Their stories, their knowledge, too, is experientially derived. It is rich in particulars. What it enables is an ever-sharpened seeing and acting on the part of those who learn it. Being told the stories of the bear sharpens the capacity to observe the bear. Being told stories about humans and bears increases the capacity to approach the bear, and so on. Another distinction. While Western science forces nature to perform in certain ways, Indian knowledge refuses to. Theoretically, Western science relies upon experimentation. A laboratory experiment involves the elaborate construction of limits and forces on processes. Nature is compelled to perform and thus to reveal itself. Think of the tremendous expenditure of time and energy and materials involved, for example, with a particle collider, a high-speed particle collider, through which alone we know things about subatomic particles. Western science makes nature perform and then records and analyzes and abstracts from what is observed. Practically, then, Western knowledge is deployed in engineering projects. Disciplines like geology are almost entirely given over to practices of extraction. Western society scientifically forces the earth into certain forms. It bores deep holes in the earth to suck out its minerals and energies. And note that mining and extraction, a forcible relation with the earth, were already central practices for the West before they were rationalized as scientific and fit into ever more engineered, ever more complex supply chains. The conquistadors forced the indigenous people underground to dig out gold. They died there quickly, and the gold funded the growth of the nation-state as we now know it. Indian knowledge refuses such forcible interaction with nature. It's not knowledge that comes from such force, but imbalance. The elaborate geological spectrographs which map the Earth's riches are not truly knowledge. They are tools inseparable from the extractive, exploitative practices of a certain dominating society. And then lastly, this brings us to a distinction between Western and Indian ideas about ethics. The Western view, still dominant, is that morality, valuation, and ethics are specific to the subjective sphere, to the human social domain. It is orthodoxy in our canons that no values can be found in the so-called objective world. As in Hobbes or Nietzsche, there are no right or wrong in natural processes or predator-prey chains. All that supposedly unfolds according to mechanistically conceived natural laws, and in the case of animals, including humans, according to something called instinct, which Deloria says is just a name for mechanistic causation in the human body. Values, ethics, right and wrong, on the other hand, are for the West confined either to the interior, subjective, psychological sphere of the human being, think back to Marcuse, or to social systems which select and impose such values generally for the purposes of dominating classes. Again, the basic idea, nature is unrelated to morality. What should be done, responsibilities and obligations, have nothing to do with the material world. Here is the contrast with the Indian view. For Indians, according to Deloria, nature is full up with ethical relations and obligations. In fact, there exists no natural situation which is not composed of relations between people and animals, people and plants, plants and animals, people and animals and plants and minerals and wind, and so on. All reality is ecological. All reality is situational. All situations are relational, and all relations are ethical. Any aspect of the natural world with which we come into perceptual, experiential contact is always already related to us. Whatever we perceive, whatever we interact with, asks us for something. For Deloria and Wildcat, there is always something appropriate, always some action that is ethically correct. But that ethical behavior is not a matter of abstract rules that must always be followed, not at all. It is always circumstantially determined. But we can be aided in that by hearing the experiences of elders who have also related with coyotes, trees, lizards, mountains, winds. To return to power and place. Power, for Deloria and Wildcat, does not at all imply domination, though of course that is the most common association on the Western colonial view. Power, for Deloria and Wildcat, refers first of all to physical, local situations. Specifically, it names the infinitely deep and broad system of forces and entities which are always already right here with us, and often passing through us, though we are mostly unconscious of them. We live immersed in power. We exist in a network of power. Cultivating good relationships is a way to cultivate this power ourselves. These relations go beyond us, by definition. We are related to other forms of life, other material processes, the land beneath our feet, and of course, with other people. To each of these, something is owed. Or more specifically, there exists a set of appropriate interactions, ways of cultivating, or as they say, completing these relations. So ethics, questions about what we should do, are not just human, or even worse, just psychological realities. They are immanent to, that means at no distance from, our natural embeddedness itself. The Indian view is thus that the Western colonizers' genocidal and ecologically devastating violence corresponds to their severance from real situational community. Because we believe in an internal world, because we live in a net of abstractions, not a net of life, we systematically trample the earth, other life forms, and the first peoples themselves. What is lost when indigenous culture is lost, therefore, is not some primitive or undeveloped way of living. It's the proper, respectful, sustainable, and meaningful way of living. It's no accident that Nietzsche and existentialism are compelled to declare life has no meaning. It's a reflection of the very way of life they inhabited. a way of life which alienates from real relations and thus weakens, disempowers us. Personality, a rich, meaningful being, a rich, meaningful life, only truly exists in the particular, not abstractly, as a cultivation of power in particular places. Now, a second topic here, related to the first. It'll come back to contexts, places, and concrete relations. This is the question of self-determination. Deloria points out that self-determination became a favorite way of talking about freedom and a favorite goal for oppressed peoples, primarily in the course of the nationalist decolonial movements post-World War II. Deloria and Wildcat accept this goal as legitimate. Self-determination is indeed something worth striving for, but they question its meaning and its depth at the political level and at the educational level. One basic problem is that Native American peoples cannot just push the colonizers out. They are surrounded. They are a small minority, and their situation has been formalized as one where they are internal to another society. So how is self-determination to occur when Native peoples are treated as a subset of United States or Canadian citizens, and when their lands are considered a subset of so-called American and Canadian land? This is where the problem begins. Another way to put this is colonization is still occurring, especially through the politics of self-determination and the education that goes with it. Historically, Indian education has been indoctrination in white people's ways. Their languages, their habits, their religion, their attire, everything. Check out the history of Indian boarding schools if you want to be stunned by the violence involved in this process. When, in the latter half of the 20th century, Indian self-determination is again allowed by these colonial powers as a viable political path, the self-determination that is meant is just another variety of assimilation. Deloria and Wildcat point out that the self-administration of Indian territory by Indians is still caused to exist within a capitalist economy, where the deals to be made involve, famously, casinos, and ubiquitously, the allowing of oil companies and ranchers to exploit Indian land for very low prices. The self-determining education that is offered to Indian youth goes along with this endeavor. These youth are being trained to self-administer, that is, to take over the low-level bureaucratic functions, to administer their own land, according to larger social and economic agendas that are totally foreign to Indian ways of life. And many Indian youth are deceived, and they go for it. And they repeat that they are indeed self-determining, when in fact, their self-determination is itself determined from without. I would ask you also to ask if your own education does not have a similar flavor. Aren't you constantly told that education will lead you to success and happiness? But what kind of success? What kind of happiness? Isn't it always success in accumulating money and rising within the ranks of a corporation or other hierarchical institution? Don't working-class black and brown youth become low-level bureaucrats in the heteronomous systems that manage their communities, systems the overall character and function of which are in no way determined by these low-level employees? Aren't we still colonized? And further, isn't this education of ours still largely indoctrination in the white world? Aren't you encouraged to speak in professional ways which exclude how your families and neighbors speak? Aren't you encouraged to dress in professional ways, which are distinct in the same way? Perhaps the Indian problem is a broader problem. Perhaps we are all colonized, albeit in varying degrees. The educational system that both Indian youth and you yourselves are engaged in is a Western one with typically Western features. In addition to the problems with abstraction versus experience named above, and isn't it perpetually true that most book learning and college education are alienated from practical everyday life? What if our education functions, among other things, simply to break the working class into segments who no longer recognize one another or work together? Anyway, in addition to these problems of abstraction, there's also one of fragmentation. I'm referring to disciplinarity. In the Western system, everybody becomes a specialist. We focus on our discipline. We know from the perspective of a certain discipline, each of which is distinguished by a certain vocabulary, a certain canon, a certain set of methodologies. Becoming an expert in our field gets us prestige within the field if we are lucky, but it doesn't translate into actually knowing the world. Far from it. Deloria and Wildcat claim that this fragmentation of knowledge, field from field, and academy from reality, is typical of the West, and distinct from the Indian way. Our knowledge ought instead to be holistic, practical, particular, and what I will call in this class praxical, connected to contexts by action. Now, as for self-determination, that is still, for Deloria and Wildcat, a valid goal. The question is self-determination in what respects and to what degree? How can indigenous society determine its full way of life and the full relation to its land? This seems to imply a fundamental militancy on the part of Indian peoples and a fundamental pushback against the entire colonial framework and the entire industrial state capitalist society. This is what Alfred will refer to as resurgence. And there's a model here, too, of a post-colonial order, one that would resemble the shifting federations and coalitions that once covered North America. They, and here is one among many correspondences between this indigenous thought and contemporary anarchist thought, they envision a world that is a sort of patchwork of different self-determining practices, cultures, languages, and identities, with locally rooted groups developing culture out of their own very specific physical and relational contexts. Such a structure could emerge if resurgence were to occur more broadly, and it would imply the throwing off of state hierarchies and economic monopolies. Such movements seem even to exist. For example, in Rojava, in northern Syria, with the Kurds, where we'll end this course, with Öcalan, in Chiapas, with the Zapatistas, even in Jackson, Mississippi, with the Jackson-Cush plan pursued by the Malcolm X grassroots movement. So, let me conclude by suggesting that in our study, we de-emphasize disciplinarity. I'm not concerned to do political science, or labor studies, or philosophy, although I teach all those things, supposedly, or social science, or critical theory, or critical race studies, or ethnic studies. I'm concerned to speak honestly about what we are really doing right here, what we are perceiving, what we are doing, and how we can increasingly cultivate our perceptions of our relations, how we can do what is appropriate in those relations with one another, and with the infinitely deep contexts in which we are really materially embedded. How do we decolonize education right here in this place? Tougher question when we're on Zoom, right? What all powers do we, as a group, as a class, potentially compose ourselves, which could be brought to completion through the appropriate, meaningful, respectful set of practices? What would those practices be? What does our situation call for? And will we do it?